Welcome to Bottom Line's Top Dollars,
a podcast about all the money things you suspect might be ruining your life.
I'm Laura Boo, recording from Montreal, Quebec, Canada.
And I'm Hadassah Damian, part of the 5% coronavirus shutdown reduction in carbon emissions, sitting in my apartment in Brooklyn, New York.
Together, we are the Ladies Who Crunch, two artists and researchers who have made careers for themselves in finance.
And today's topic is climate nihilism. The climate crisis can be very overwhelming, and when we feel hopeless, it's easy to give in to inaction. Today, we're going to face those feelings and look at how we can use what financial power we do have to address climate change. But first, let's take a minute to talk about the plethora of things we will not be talking about today. Laura?
First of all, we are not going to enter into the argument of whether or not climate change is real, because FYI, it is. And we are not going to talk about the science of why or anything like that, because that's not our area of expertise. We're not tackling everything that has to do with climate change. And we're not going to talk about every possible financial issue that is connected to climate change, because we're going to come back to that over and over and over again. We're going to talk about climate change a lot.
Much like all of us for the next multiple decades of our lives.
Exactly. We should all be talking about climate change all the time is the message. And because of that, we're going to talk about climate change over and over again on this podcast in the future. So don't expect this to be everything. It's just the beginning. So what are we going to focus on? We're going to ask three big things. One, what is climate nihilism? And look at how that is similar to how we also feel about money often.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we want to look at what is the scale and the nature of the problem of climate change itself.
Like, how do we start to understand it?
Mm-hmm. And this is the third part. We're going to look at personal choices and what we can do to actually address climate change.
Yeah, we're going to go face into one of the big fears, which is, do my choices make any difference? You know, or is it all an illusion? So we're really going to dig into some of the facts behind what it's possible to do, the scale of change, scale of the problem. And hopefully you're going to leave this episode with a bit more information about what's possible, what's reasonable for you to expect when we're talking about such a large and interconnected systematic set of problems. And so, like the mindful and thoughtful queer folks that we are, we're going to start by talking about feelings.
So many feelings.
I mean, it is our planet. I guess I have some feelings about it.
Yeah, and I think everyone does. I felt like there was this long year of everyone in my circle of friends talking about how much climate grief and how deep and desperate they were feeling about climate change. And then the pandemic happened. And for some people, it was compounded. For some people, it was replaced. But overall, I feel like a lot of the things that I was hearing from people and a lot of the things that I read about as far as how people feel about climate change is so similar to everything I hear when people talk about money. There's fear and panic, feeling overwhelmed, like you don't understand what's going on, that you don't even feel like you have the capacity to understand. It's not just that you don't know, it's that you can't even know. And that often leads to this sense of hopelessness, which can lead to inaction or avoidance. When people talk about when they get mail from their student loan collections or from the Canada Revenue Agency and they just don't want to open the envelope.
I've been reflecting on like 5 years of seeing clients with Ride Free Fearless Money. And one of my observations is that there's like this sense of untouchableness, I think, that a lot of people bring to their money, which could be literal, right? I don't open the envelope. I don't even want to look at the envelope. Or it could be more like avoidance tactics. Like, I just don't open the app. I don't ever download my pay stub. Like, I just avoid all the details around it because it is or is part of or represents a system that is just completely baffling and deeply uncomfortable for me. And so, yeah, I think absolutely, like, the approach to trying to understand something that is like completely completely in a state of motion and is deeply uncertain brings up so many of these like shadow tactics that so many of us have behaviorally. It's something that we saw when coronavirus started in March and April, and it's still very uncertain, but more things are certain than they were, is that like people's behaviors around uncertainty started surfacing, which are unsurprisingly, people look for what is certain. And that doesn't mean that they look for facts or truth or whatever necessarily. Often we just look for the thing that we can rely on, that we feel certain in, even if that is our ability to bury our heads in the sand and not know. I'm certain that I don't know. That's the only thing I know. So therefore, I'm going to dig into how much I don't know and avoid the topic. It's a behavioral pattern that is not healthy, but it's common.
I think that it's understandable to feel fear and feel panic when you read about climate change. And every time there's a new article, a new scientific study, every time you see someone share something on social media, I think that fear and panic is normal because it is really, really scary. And I think that it's what happens next that is where we want to dig in, which is if you feel overwhelmed and if you feel that fear and that panic, what do you do with it? Do you allow the mm-hmm. hopelessness to push you into a state of inaction or avoidance and into what a lot of people call climate grief, so a state of depression about a loss of a future, or climate nihilism, which is more a feeling that there is no longer a meaning or purpose to life because of this impending climate disaster. And this idea that if we are all doomed, that the apocalypse has already happened and we're just living out in the end times, then there is no reason to plan for the future or to do anything. What does it mean when we don't even want to do something anyway? And then there's this reason to just ignore it. Like, you don't really want to think about investing your money or how to save for the future or go to school to change your profession or save for a home. Why should you bother doing any of these things, having kids, if the timeline of life on Earth has been cut short? So if nothing really matters anymore, you know, fuck it. It's really just like a fuck everything kind of vibe.
Totally. And I wonder too, like, back to this idea of like behavior and how people act in uncertainty, because it's uncertain what the timeline is. It's uncertain what the sort of personal, systemic, institutional, global, national responses are going to be and at what scale, that then people are leaning into what's certain. They're like, well, the end is definitely coming, so I'm just going to act like it's already here. And in some way, there's this like parallel with people who refuse to wear masks in coronavirus. They're like, because they're kind of saying, well, I might get it, so why don't I just make it more possible that I get it, so I just get it over with. It's like living as if the end state has already happened, but it hasn't. Right? It's a maladaptive approach to trying to be in uncertainty. And there's two like behavioral concepts I want to bring in. A study that got done in 2012 across 20 countries that found that 14%, so that's about like 1 in 7 of people, believe the world is going to end in their lifetime. So it's just common to believe that the world is, that we're in the end days. There was like a whole set of books that got written like after, quote, the Great War, that indicated that people started to believe that these are the end times. Things will never be worse than they are now. I think that sort of potential propensity that some people have, 1 in 7, 22% of the people in the US and Turkey believe that the world is about to end in their lifetime, coincides with this like way that we approach uncertainty and coincides with this other behavior that is known colloquially as bike shedding, but it's formerly Parkinson's law of triviality. And it's essentially this idea that like if you get a group of people in a room and you ask them to respond to topics, that it's the most trivial topic is the one that people will spend the most amount of time on because we feel that we can't engage with the complex topics. And so the example that this guy who came up with it, Parkinson, gives is like you're at a town hall meeting and you're asking people in town who've shown up to the meeting, you know, should we open a nuclear power plant? How much money should we put in the budget for the climate resilience budget? And what color should we paint the bike sheds? And you're going to get an inverse amount of time spent on the least important thing, the bike shed color, as compared compared to how expensive or important or major the decisions are for the other things. Because we tend to feel overwhelmed by things that we believe we have no expertise in, or that are outside of our scope of understanding, or that we can't speak to. But I think it's important to know that we have all these tendencies to act as if we don't know, and to want to be certain in the face of uncertainty.
I think that people cling to comforting things. And I think the bike shed color is a comforting decision, because it feels like it is something that you can understand and grasp and handle and do, and it feels positive. Avoidance is often about clinging to those things that feel comforting. I think that we need to face those feelings of climate nihilism, climate denial, climate grief, because avoidance can work temporarily, but often it makes the outcomes worse in the end. And that's also true for when you don't open those letters from the Canada Revenue Agency or student loan collectors. There's also a piece there that's about white privilege and class privilege. Those most able to survive the negative outcomes of their own avoidance, those are the people with the most power. Those are the people who would have the most positive impact if they turned around and faced the issue. There's several ways that we can face those feelings. We wanted to start the conversation with this because I worry that people are going to open up their podcast app and they're going to see the title Climate Nihilism and they're going to skip listening to this episode because they have climate nihilism or they don't want to face it. There are ways that we can feel afraid and feel overwhelmed and feel panicked and still engage with it, still actually face it, and not resort to giving up or just doing something else. And we live in a society where there's lots of ways to distract ourselves. Two of the ways that we talked about this, I'm going to actually start with what I like to call like the pragmatic approach, or like the approach, you know, my mom Judy would take, which actually is also kind of a gambler mentality of hedging your bets, which might tell you a little bit about what my mom is like. But in this idea, you know, you can either do nothing and then the world will either end or it won't. You won't participate in the outcome. The outcome will just happen without you. Or you can do something and then the world will still either end or it won't. Under the second circumstance, you both increase the chances of the world not ending and you increase the chance that your situation in the not ended world is probably going to be better.
Right. And the other way you can face these feelings, as opposed to just like hard logic dice rolling, Judy, thank you so much, is doing some like imagination work, flexing your speculative power. You have to get through some of the stages of grief on that this one, because you have to accept that the past is gone, right? Since the year 2000, globally, we've increased our emissions 50%. This is what's happened. The past is gone. People will beat themselves up over past decisions, but it's like you just can't go back. You're only in the present from which you can make your next decision. So your most strategic move is actually to imagine, to speculate, you know, ideate yourself into the next thing you can do, imagining a positive future, imagining an outcome that you want to take some action into. Even if you have to give yourself, again, like, I can have like horrific nihilistic ideas for 20 minutes, but then I have to spend 20 minutes imagining something that I want to have happen. And so that I can get into a place where I can take some action, right? And this, like, I think swirls around the edge of like magical thinking, positivity bias. It's like, yeah, you're allowed to be reasonable and rational in this. You don't have to be like, oh, it's going to be fine. I'll just dream, you know, climate change away. Like, that's not it. What I'm inviting you all to do is to imagine the fact that you do have some power to make some change in the world.
Yeah. And it's believing that that's possible. It's fighting to win.
And that's also fighting to get yourself to fight. We're not done yet, y'all.
On the left, wherever you find yourself on that spectrum, if you do find yourself on that spectrum, people can get into a it's impossible, especially because the right is constantly telling us that our political ideas are impossible. Our ideas for social change are completely impractical or impossible. Sometimes you can get yourself into this place where you're like, well, we're never going to win. the end of the world is going to come and everything is screwed. That's the mentality where you say, okay, if you're going to let yourself have that speculative power, let yourself be the fool who says, I believe that we can win and I'm going to fight to win. And it's not saying that we're going to win without me doing anything. It's saying, if I put this effort in, we can get there. So now that we've kind of talked about the feelings that sometimes make us want to give up, we're going to turn and start to look at the problem and ask, what is the scale and cause of the climate crisis that we're currently facing?
Yeah. Why might you be feeling nihilistic at times? Look, we're going to start with the timeline. It's hotly debated. We are not climate scientists. So just broad strokes here. The timeline of action that needs to be taken is 2030 is a major date. 2020 was a major date, but that goodbye. 2030 is the next major date by which really important action needs to be taken to move towards addressing climate change.
If you want to talk about the size of the problem to try and make it more real and tangible, we try to bring it into the personal and look at it on three levels: short term, medium term, long term. So on the short term, we're talking about right now until about 2030, we're already seeing impacts of climate change because we have already, through actions up until today, warmed the planet by about a degree. And we're already seeing extreme weather. There's been so many storms this year. They've already gone through the whole alphabet and now they're in the Greek alphabet. We're seeing huge amounts of wildfire. Like, you know, last year, all of Australia pretty much burned down. And all of these increasingly intense weather patterns, on a personal level, either you live in one of these places where you have been impacted by these disasters, and even if you haven't, you're probably going to see a rising cost of insurance for travel, for your home. You're going to see rising costs of electricity and a decrease in water and fresh water availability. This is all already starting to happen on the short term.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this medium term, kind of getting us to 2050, now we're starting to get into sea level rise. And so homes can be lost, or just real estate value could be lost due to inhabitability. Once we're getting to 2050, we're looking at, if you work outdoors or just enjoy being outdoors, it could become unbearably warm to be there. Health and mental health impacts are really going to start to kick up, because if it's warmer longer, there's more pollen, there's more mosquitoes, there's just more health issues kicking around. And there's just the accumulated impacts of trauma and stress on mental health.
And then on the long term, 2050 onwards, we're really starting to look at collapse of ecosystems, agriculture, at a level that is going to have massive impacts on the global supply chain of food. We're also going to be looking at global climate migration. There's going to be big pieces of the world that are going to become uninhabitable. And so we will have massive amounts of climate refugees. We keep bringing this back to costs because, you know, we're doing this
money podcast,
this ladies who crunch thing. And this is really going to affect things like whether or not you are going to have enough resources or money, if it still exists, to get a hold of all the things you basically need to survive. Whether you're going to have to leave the place that you are, and if you're going to have enough resources to get to somewhere where you can be safe. Like we said, we're not climate scientists. We just gave a few examples to try and illustrate that increasingly disastrous timeline that we're looking at if we don't curb the warming of the earth. There's so many more that you could go into. But what is the cause of this problem? The earth is increasing in temperature because of carbon emissions. 70% comes from companies and countries, like massive level infrastructure, manufacturing, and commercial activity. That's where 70% of the carbon emissions come from. And 30% of the carbon emissions come from lifestyle spending, from the consumption of regular everyday people, the activities of people living on the planet. Of that 30%, the kind of largest amount of emissions on a personal level come from the top 10% wealthiest people on the planet. And if you're wondering who that is, the income line of how much money you need to make to be considered to be part of that top 10% globally is $38,000 US, right? So in Canada, just take that and multiply it by like 1.3. You might not identify as a wealthy person, but on a global level, if you make more than $38,000 US per year, then your consumption and impact is so much more than the average person on the planet.
Absolutely. And then to be in the top 1% of people impacting generally is people who make $105,000 a year and up. And so that includes billionaires, but also just a whole bunch of folks in technology like myself. And that group of people is responsible for 15% of lifestyle carbon emissions. So yes, we're talking about jet setters, but we're also talking about people who fly around the globe to go to various work events or who have cars. Like, this is where I think we start to get into the sticky and confusing, the hard issues. So if 30% essentially of emissions are like lifestyle and consumer spending, the other 70% are commercial. Over half of these like global industrial emissions can be traced back to just 25 corporate and state producing entities. So there's one way in which you can look at a very small group of very powerful polluters, essentially, to point the responsibility at.
We've got these two kind of big categories. We've got the 70% and the 30%. The 70% are these institutional emitters, let's call them. The few who have the most impact. And then on the other side, you've got the 30%. This is, in essence, the impact of every single individual on the planet in their individual personal consumption.
Which is not trivial. 30% is a lot of impact.
BP came out a couple years ago with this campaign, you know, we all need to recycle and our personal consumption decisions are like the turning point. And I think that that was a little bit of sleight of hand.
BP is the 14th largest emitter company globally in history. So that's interesting that they would come out with that.
Exactly. And I think that when they're doing that, my natural response is like, okay, friend, I think you need to look in the mirror before you talk to me about my recycling.
I'm talking to the man in the mirror.
Exactly. So I understand that there's been this huge, very important political push to say we need to focus on this 70%, because if we can get these few but high impact actors to change, that's going to be a major move of the dial, which is 100% true. But if we look at the goal, mitigating global warming by cutting greenhouse gas emissions by half by 2030 and eliminating emissions, which means total net zero emissions by 2050. We have to do that or better, or we're totally fucked. We can't do that if we also don't address the 30%. Yeah, we need to definitely go after those huge monsters, but we need to address both sides of it to get to net zero. And here's a big reminder. This is like an artificial grouping, and these two are actually totally connected. These companies don't act without the complicity and the demand created by the consumers who drive cars and fly in airplanes all around the world and eat a ton of meat and do all these things.
Or like who are like emerging economies who are, you know, who are like, oh, you developed countries want us to not actually get to the place where you are. There's a whole intersecting web of players at play and of different privileges that are at play. And I think especially in like the Western world, we are in a very privileged position where we're saying, what are we going to cut? Because what we're also asking other countries and like massive numbers of people to ask themselves is, what are you never going to have? You know, and that's one of the frameworks right now. And so I think just remembering, again, if you're in that top 10%, you're asking questions from a place of having. So we're going to start talking about solutioning. Right? Like, what is it you can do when you're asking these questions? What does it mean? Just a couple notes on this. We're working with like some rough brush strokes in terms of timelines. We don't know when the timer is going to go off, but we're operating in this like 10 years to make a big dent is pretty important as our operating framework to mitigate warming by cutting greenhouse gas emissions in multiple ways. We're about to list a bunch of things that honestly could all be their own episodes, some of which will be. We're going to list things that can be done briefly on the sort of like a global scale, and then a little bit more on the personal scale. And I just want to name that there's a difference between having a list of the things that you can do or should do or are supposed to do and actually doing the things. Like there's so much aspirational lists and shame filled mea culpa. I should, I was supposed to. And so I just want to acknowledge that getting yourself to do things, is it making behavioral change is harder than just knowing what to do. So if you feel overwhelmed, I really want to encourage you to remember you don't have to do all of the things. Overwhelming yourself by saying, well, I have to do everything or there's no point, often leads to not taking any action at all. So as you're thinking about these things and listening to this list that we have coming up, think about one or two things that you are excited about that feel feasible for you and get yourself to do those. Because look, we have some proof that action does change outcomes. Back to what I said at the beginning, you know, in March and April, the first wave of shutdowns globally due to coronavirus led to a 5% reduction in fossil fuel use. Therefore, what we do and don't do actually does have impact.
I really love this saying, which is don't allow the perfect to get in the way of the good.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're about to go into like an overwhelming list of possibilities of how you can behave, how you can act, but don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. So we're going to split up the tactical actions into two categories, political action and economic action. We're going to go over the political action section pretty quickly. We think it's necessary to talk about it because it's an essential part of this battle. And it's the part where you can try and get at that 70%. But we're going to actually spend more time on the economic action, specifically on a personal level, because we're the ladies who crunch and that's our jam. We talk about money. So we're going to talk about both, but we're going to focus on the economic. So let's get onto a list of the kinds of political pressures that you can place on carbon emitters. I think that there are some people who are kind of diehard activists who are like, I got this. This is my profession. I just wait tables to fund this. But some people are completely lost when you say take political action. So we're going to go through a bunch of things that you can do, starting with you can get out in the streets and you can protest. There's been huge global actions, especially student strikes led by youth. There have been so many actions that are indigenous led. Get out there and be part of the mass of people showing numbers and support for this kind of change.
Indeed, you can, when you're protesting, advocate for your workplace, your city, or your school and their pension fund to divest from being invested in fossil fuels. Or you personally can divest your investments from fossil fuels as well.
You can also sign or start petitions. I know that this seems like kind of your grandma's politics, but putting your name to things and adding numbers to petitions can actually be really useful as a way to communicate political will to not just political or governmental organizations, but also there are petitions that are addressed to companies asking them to change their policies and their actions.
Yeah, absolutely. And tied into that is communicating with government representatives at all levels. In particular, the more local the representative, the more weight that your voice and your communication has. And to do it regularly. And this could include anything from like answering surveys that come through to phone calls to emails, especially in municipal offices. There's somebody whose job it is to just keep a list of people who call and the topics that they're asking about. So talking about topics and saying, I'm calling because I'm concerned about this does have an impact.
And you can also use your cash to fund these actions. So donating money to organizations fighting for climate justice or participating in fundraising for these organizations. Remember that with all these political actions, you know, you don't need to be the leader. Like if you don't need to listen to this podcast and suddenly be the person who starts a movement, like this movement is already in progress. It's just waiting for you to join. So connect with climate justice groups and find out what they need from you. And I'll tell you right now that the leadership, it's coming from Indigenous voices, especially on Turtle Island and island nations who are most impacted by sea level rise, there are already robust and long-standing movements. You can support those movements led by Indigenous folks and people of color.
And so when you're protesting and communicating and donating and helping, what is it that we're fighting for? And we wanted to include this section because sometimes we can be vague, you know, like climate justice now, but like, what does that actually mean?
Yeah. What are you going to put on your sign?
Yeah. What's on the back of your sign? Climate justice now is on the front, and on the back, you are going to be specifically asking for one of these things we're about to list. But overall, what we're looking for, what we need, is a complete global infrastructure shift to renewable energy. So that looks like wind, that looks like electrics, that looks like solar, and to non-extractive manufacturing, e.g. leave it in the ground. It's in there, let it be, right? And part of that is looking for, therefore, companies and countries to pivot to like sustainable, e.g. net zero, and or more socially responsible operations. It's not a small ask, let's be honest, but like, here's some of the economic asks. All right, Laura, tap.
We basically need to push government actors to say, you know what, climate change issues to the front. Some of the policies that can be enacted are things like cap and trade or carbon taxes. And we're not going to, you know, that's a whole other podcast to explain how those two things work and the debate between them. There's also the Green New Deal that specifically an American concept, but I think that it's really caught on in the imagination of other countries that they too could enact a version of the Green New Deal, which is kind of this sweeping policy to invest in renewables and create jobs to build those renewables. In essence, shifting the entire nation's economy, whether your nation is the US or in my case, Canada or anywhere else. What else? What else have we got on our list?
Well, look, it's just in general policies that incentivize transition, right? So whether that's like small scale individual homeowners getting tax benefits for installing solar, or across China and the US, they saw a 30% increase in wind and solar because developers are incentivized and therefore rushing to complete projects that have these incentives built into them.
Now we're going to shift and we're going to start looking at personal and consumer and lifestyle choices. So this is the economic part. We're going to talk right now about how you can use what economic resources you have to make choices in your own life that can shift that needle. There's kind of a debate here where a lot of people talk about whether or not this is the place to put a lot of effort, considering that, you know, now we're looking at that 30% of individual action, whereas on the political level, we were looking at that 70% of institutional action. Again, I'm going to remind you that if we're going to get to net zero, we need to do this part as well.
Let's scale down the goal a little bit, because getting to net zero just feels overwhelming. In the late 2020s, the average global greenhouse gas emitted per person, so you, one person, was about 7 tons per year. Like a tenth of that was food being transported around and fertilizers for it, things like that. A little over 1 ton from homes on average, 0.8 tons from transport. And so if that's what was happening a couple of years ago on average per person, knowing that on average, the more money that you make and jets that you fly around on, the higher that number is. Estimates of the annual carbon footprint required to meet the Paris Agreement, so to get to our 2030 goals, is 4.5 tons per person. To get to the net zero that we are aiming for, it's to get somewhere between 2.1 to 3 tons of greenhouse gas emission per person by 2050. So if you are like one of those like track everything to track your life type people, your goal by 2030 is to get to 4.5 tons of personal greenhouse gas emissions.
We're going to take empowerment wherever we can, and that this portion is about finding a path that allows you to walk the lightest, even though you know you might still be causing harm. We're going to go through ways that you can try and make your carbon footprint a little less.
Totally. Well, and one framework that I'll just make sure that we bring in here too is just this like little differentiation between like lifestyle decisions, like that are these big kind of pre-made sets of decisions on how you're going to do things, and more ad hoc, one-off consumer decisions.
It's about whether you're making a big decision that actually is thousands of decisions across your life. Like, I became a vegetarian when I was 17, and now it's 20 some years later and I'm still a vegetarian. So that was one choice when I was 17, but it actually made thousands of individual purchase decisions throughout my whole life. Comparing that to an individual decision of, do I buy this thing or do I buy that thing?
Sometimes it's just about making that one decision that you can make, but making one lifestyle decision can set you up to make a whole bunch of other decisions for you that might put you in the direction that you want to be, given your goal of 4.5 tons of emission.
If you think of all the economic resources that you have the portion of your money that you spend on living right now. You spend it on housing, you spend it on food, you spend it on whatever you spend it on right now. And then you have your excess money. Whatever you do with that, whether you keep it as cash savings or whether you invest it, maybe you don't have any excess, maybe you do. These two categories of money, you have the ability to decide how you're going to leverage both of them. Now, the excess money, that investment money, we're going to actually talk about that next week. We have an entire episode coming up about investing your money, what it is, how to do it, and there's going to be a whole section about, you know, how to invest ethically. So we're actually just going to take that whole chunk and say, check us out next week. And so we're going to focus today's discussion on what are you going to do with the money that you are using right now. The sectors that have the deepest impact on the global scale are the energy sector, transportation, and agriculture. Those are kind of the big three that on a global supply chain level create the most emissions. So those are the three places where we're going to start looking at consumer decisions that can mean the most. So the first is energy consumption decisions. Most people have not a lot of options when it comes to energy consumption in their homes. There's often where you live, there's only one supplier. For a lot of people, they don't even have any transparency about how that electricity is generated. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of consumer power, but more and more there are starting to be smaller green energy companies popping up in lots of markets. So if you live in one of those markets, you can shop around and you can get an energy audit of your home, no matter where you live or what supplier you use, in order to pinpoint where your home is energy inefficient. And then you can try and invest in renos to reduce energy loss, or if it's within your means, some kind of renovations that allow you to generate or create energy.
This is where like geothermal like builds on houses are super cool, like houses like built into the side of sandbars and things like that.
Creating passive solar.
Yeah, you know, like or earthship. But you don't have to go that deep. You don't have to live in an earthship, though it would be cool. You could just make your house leak less heat and drain less on the grid, right? So this could also be, if you rent, this could be you covering your windows with plastic in the winter.
Oh my God, out there every single fall with like the hairdryer and an extension cord trying to do that cling wrap thing. I know it's annoying, but it really does make a difference. And then transportation decisions. So this is another big energy consumption. When we talk about transportation, the big kind of monolith consumer of emissions is actually the travel that for a lot of us is the kind we take the least, which is massive international air travel.
So avoiding one round-trip transatlantic flight saves 1.6 tons of carbon emissions. So back to your 2030 goal, that's a third for the year.
So this is one of these kind of larger lifestyle goals, because I think that being globe-trotting world travelers is kind of
fun.
Well, it's fun, but I think it's also become the new way to kind of show status symbol in a generation. Home ownership is no longer accessible in the way that it used to be. So many people that I know, being world travelers is the joy of their life. And I get it, but this comes back to making those kind of large lifestyle decisions about saying how much travel should you have in comparison to other people on the planet.
Totally. And the way I've seen some people approach this is also think about, like, in some ways almost having an internal carbon budget, because international, like, transatlantic travel is so carbon expensive. Maybe you're thinking about having that travel be, you know, something you do, you save up, right? Like, maybe, so if you choose not to have a car, for example, you save 2.4 tons of emissions, which is, you know, almost half of what you're trying to have for the year. So maybe you're making some choices there, but it's all about having the sense of what things are you going to pick to have some big impact. Perhaps you want to live close to where you work or have a remote job, or choose transportation that is transporting other people, right? Like buses or subways. Or maybe you're just going to transport yourself, like riding a bicycle, if that feels accessible to you. I've been, a bike commuter for over 20 years. And, it's a really nice way to get to work.
You can also participate in the sharing economy. I've been a member of a car share service here in Montreal called Communauto for about 5 years now. And it's a wonderful way to take cars off the road and still be able to travel. I use it to go back and forth to visit my in-laws, but I don't own a car. So this is one way in which you can take a measure that is not the fully 100% pure righteous decision, but it is one way to say, I am finding that path that allows me to walk lighter. And I know I'm still doing harm, but it is reducing that harm.
Because this is a good moment to remind ourselves that, like, with this list of examples, nobody's going to do all of them. Like, that's not actually feasible in life.
Oh my God.
And so we're not here to be righteous at you. There's no gold star in capitalism.
Oh my God. And what is the point of that? I think that the kind of gold starism, it really is the worst kind of argument. It's like how people go after Greta with the most insane arguments, like how she came over from Europe to North America on like a wind, wind powered boat. And then people were like, I saw her get into a taxi. She rode in a car. And they were, you know, people were snapping photos of her and putting them on the internet as a way to discredit her because she had been in a vehicle. And I'm like, she just went across the Atlantic on a sailboat.
Yeah.
I'm like, let her take a cab. To me, it's not about being perfect. With that, let's hit that third of the big three. You know, the big three were energy, transportation, and agriculture. So agriculture, this is where we get into food decisions. And I am telling you, if you want to see people get defensive, talk to them about what they eat. And I get it. You know what I mean? I totally get it. But if you just want the numbers, dairy and meat industries account for 14.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Meat and dairy. Womp. So a big way that you can bring down demand for meat and dairy is by not eating it or eating much less of it. And when you bring down that demand, it will bring down the impact of that industry. Another is don't waste food. Buy local so that, you know, the impact of transportation on what you eat is less. If you think about the carbon emissions related to the banana that you eat here in Montreal or in Brooklyn or wherever you are, it's astonishing.
These are the three bigs. If you can hit something in any one of these, you're going to have the biggest impact, right? Around food and agriculture, around transportation, energy consumption. But of course, there's other things that you can do at the sort of micro decision level. Fixing stuff rather than buying new stuff. Or if something breaks, just don't replace it. Like, you know, you might have enough stuff. Maybe you can fix what you have or borrow from somebody else if you need a thing.
And this is one that I'm going to confess I have huge struggles with, is stop buying so much friggin' clothes. Fast fashion actually is responsible for 5% of global greenhouse emissions. And this was, of all the statistics I looked at, this was the one that was most shocking to me, that fashion and fast fashion specifically, and when we talk about fast fashion, we mean the extra cheap clothing that you can buy, like the Zara, the Forever 21, the H&M of fashion, that it's 5% of global emissions.
And part of that is like the polyester fabrics that the stuff is made out of. Polyester is made of oil, y'all. It's petroleum based. And then there's like all of the the shipping to get it everywhere, you know, to get the petroleum to a place where it can be made into fabric, to that fabric to be somewhere where it can be cut and sewed at like a very cheap price and then sent somewhere else where it can get paid a premium for.
How can you cut this down? So if you love fashion, just thrift it instead.
Hell yes. There's enough clothes made for all of us. Like no more clothes need to be actually be made. It's my opinion.
Or you just limit the number of new wardrobe purchases made in a year. So there's the piece where you're like online and clicking through whatever website thinking about buying a thing, and that's a micro decision. Or you can let some of that pressure out and set a goal for yourself saying, you know what, this year I am only going to buy thrifted clothes and a maximum of X number of pieces of new clothes. Bring your consumption down. If you don't feel like you can bring it down to zero, move the needle a little bit. And I know that there's an element of self-soothing to consumption. I know that when I freak out and had a body dysmorphic moment, going online and buying something to wear that is beautiful and then getting it and feeling better. I feel like that's a coping mechanism I was taught as a child and a teenager. And right now, when there's not much else to feel good about, I can understand how that kind of shopping makes us feel better. But I guess in this huge list of things that we just gave you, what we're saying is individual choices about what you buy, how you spend your money, bigger lifestyle choices about how you choose to live, how big of a house you have, whether you drive a car, how many trips you take in a year, and what kind of diet you have, and even whether or not you decide to do things like have kids, what city you decide to live in, where you decide to work. All of these decisions about your economic power and the makeup of your life, they actually do have an impact.
Totally. And like, so back to this thing where it's like, I'm a little tiny grain of sand. Is there purpose in me changing or like taking a different action? In doing this research, it was really helpful for me to get that individual carbon goal, even though I know it's an average and even though maybe there's better data out there that one of you listeners can share with us, but to have a sort of sense of how much carbon I should be budgeting for myself for a year, it's actually really helpful because then it means that I can make, much like with like, you know, budgeting other resources like money, having a sense of what the carbon impact is for me personally means that I can make some less guilty decisions, you know, or guilt-free decisions, along with like some practical and pragmatic decisions on like what to scale back on. So I have more carbon budget to do what I'm going to do with, you know, and I think like this type of thinking might very well be in our futures as globally, nationally, and locally, we are trying to figure out how to help people be mindful.
One last piece that I wanted to talk about is that fatigue where we feel like if we need to focus on every single decision at a micro level, the weight of all of the decisions together and the weight of feeling like unless it's perfect, it's not worth doing at all can be overwhelming and can contribute to that sense of nihilism. If you feel like you can't do everything, then you might as well do nothing. This all or nothing kind of thinking got us here in the first place, to look at it in a way where you do what you can and believing that it does have an impact. Number one, in that personal sense where we're looking at getting our personal carbon emissions down enough. But like I said earlier, the dichotomy of the big emitters versus all the people on the planet and them being two separate categories is a fallacy. It's not true. Our decisions about how we consume and what we buy drives the global economy. If there are massive shifts in consuming energy, food, transportation, clothes, everything, that will change the patterns of demand and it will change what companies make, how much of it they make, and how they operate. You are part of a system of supply and demand, and it will have larger reverberations.
Yeah, it's interesting. Shell Oil Company, their CEO recently said that they think about themselves as a climate transition company now. It feels like the language is greenwashing, but also Shell, being in the top 25 emitters of the globe, needs to be a company that is thinking of itself as a climate transition company. Like we need all of them to do that in order to get to net zero. And so Shell would just keep pulling oil out the ground if there wasn't a huge amount of pressure for them to change otherwise. And so in our next episode, we're going to be talking a bit more about investing, about divesting, about what is it that makes a company have value and what makes that value change. Because especially in particular with oil companies, there's been some deep devaluation that's happened. And we'll also talk in our next episode about what you can do personally to have a more ethical or more socially responsible investment portfolio or options. We'll talk about the greenwashing. We'll talk about what you might want to examine and what it might just be in your best interest to know about and keep it moving. We're going to tie it back to the climate, because what we hear with the climate is like, well, I understate what I can change, and therefore I'm not going to do anything. What we see with investing, I see this all the time with people, is I overstate the impact I think I might have, therefore I don't do anything. So really with this last couple episodes, we want you to be thinking about actions that you can take and to right size your impact that you can have.
And so that's it for this week. We'd love to hear from you. We're starting to get more and more listener mail, and it's really exciting. Please email us. Please look us up on social media and keep talking to us, because we're both at home in a pandemic.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Bottom Lines, Top Dollars.
We've been your hosts, the ladies who crunch. That's me, Laura Boo.
And me, Hadassah Damian from Ride Free Fearless Money. You can find this show and show notes on the web at ladieswhocrunch.club.
And you can find us all over social media. Just search for Bottom Lines, Top Dollars, or Ladies Who Crunch.
I want to give a special thanks to our researchers, Ariel Federo and Handy Levine, and to the wild shit show that is late stage capitalism itself. Because remember, if anything you learned or heard in this podcast made you angry, good.
If you're mad about it, we still have hope.